It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we meet the first foreigner invited to study at the Professional Chef School of Sichuan, China. Fuchsia Dunlop is a BBC journalist who fell in love with the unique food of Sichuan. It's spicy, it's hot, and it's fascinating. The Chinese call it audacious cooking. The Sterns are doing classic southern cakes in Charleston. We talk international beans and weenies with Anya von Bremsen, author of The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Wine expert Jay McInerney clues us into the wine, shoving aside Chardonnay. Then, in a bow to the current political climate, we address the issue dividing the nation, the diet war. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, it's the cuisine the chili-obsessed overlooked. Our guest, Fuchsia Dunlop, has written the West's first cookbook on China's Sichuan province. The book is Land of Plenty. Sichuan is where chili is king, Sichuan pepper is queen, and numbing is something you aim for when you cook. Well, then our favorite global food person, Anya von Bremsen, talks the world's epic bean dishes like the cassoulet of France and the feijoada feast of Brazil. We've a look at Sauvignon Blanc, and as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, I know you've eaten your way around Charleston, South Carolina, but I suspect that unless somebody told you about it, you would probably walk right past or drive right past a place called Diana's on Meeting Street. The problem with Diana's, if it's a problem, is that it looks like it is part of a Days Inn. It looks like a motel restaurant from the outside, totally unpromising. However, I remember when we first sat down there, and we only sat down because somebody tipped us off to it, we asked the waitress, is this place affiliated with the motel here? She said, we are not connected with the hotel. No way, whatsoever, not at all. End of quote.
Well, Days Inn is not that bad. I mean, it's a good place to stay.
No, it's a fine place to stay. It's just not known for their culinary wonders.
I don't think I know this place. Yeah.
Well, let me tell you what you want to start off with there. At breakfast, you really want to get their French toast, which is not just your basic slab of fried egg-dipped bread. You get huge chunks of currant berry bread stuffed with homemade sautéed apples, crisp on the outside, floating in apple cider syrup. Oh, it is to die for.
This sounds so good. Okay, what else do they do?
But wait, there's more.
Well, if you want to eat regionally for breakfast, one of the breakfast specials there is shrimp and grits. And of course, these, as you know, are the creamy grits unique to that low country location. Just like the warm, wonderful cereal, very buttery, creamy cereal.
And you know, Michael, it's not just shrimp. There's crawfish in it, too. And then over the whole schmear are freshly fried green tomatoes.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, it is so good. It is so good. And now, I know I for some reason, I always bring everything back to dessert, but I guess that is
no, they have great pastries at this
they
place.
They have cake. They have regular two-layer cake, which, again, is almost an endangered species. I'm not talking about chocolate mousse cake or any of that
stuff. This is not flourless, decadent cake whatsoever.
They have red velvet cake. Do you know what that is,
Oh, yeah.
Lynn?
These are all old. I mean, that's an old recipe, old-time Southern concept of cake.
Yes, it's a chocolate cake that has basically, I think, has red dye number two in it. I
mean, and there's plenty of
and
it.
And plenty of it. So the cake is bright red, and it's got a white buttercream frosting. They also have a sensational white coconut layer cake, which being in the South, of course, has to be damn good, or it wouldn't be on the menu.
Right,
and
exactly.
And I, being a traditionalist, I like the simple yellow butter cake with chocolate frosting. I mean, it is the platonic cake, and it is so good. And one of the great things about this place is not only are the cakes good, but they make really, really good coffee, which, as you know, Lynn, is kind of a rarity in the Deep South. I mean, good tea is everywhere, but really good, strong coffee is one of the specialties of Diana's as well.
Do they do dinner as well?
Yes, they do. And in fact, we've only had dinner there once, but it was a beauty. We had real Southern fried chicken, the way you don't get anywhere else.
And served with chipotle mashed potatoes. Mm. Oh, God, it was so delicious.
Oh, yes.
Is Diana's expensive?
No, not at all. I mean, breakfast, it's not dirt cheap. It's not like a diner cheap. I think the breakfast there are like maybe $5, $6, $7. Dinner, you're going to spend under $12 for sure for a full course meal. Well, so, no, it's not expensive.
Considering what you can spend on dinner these days, that sounds really cheap. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you can hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. I have to admit, I'm jealous. I mean, Charleston is such an eating town. Of course, I suspect that you could roam the South for years and not run out of good food. One of my dreams is having months to just wander, guided by maybe some Southern colleagues and by my backseat library. I've been collecting Southern food books for years. Now, here's some of my favorites. They all have recipes, but more important, they've got insights. And I really think that's what you need to get what you're seeing. Well, the classic work on the South is John Egerton's Southern Food. John does history, he does recipes, and he does the most local of local foods. For a guide to barbecue throughout the South, get Smokestack Lightning by Lolis Eric Eli. And for Southern Appalachia, now that's the mountains of Tennessee, Georgia, and the Carolinas, I found a wonderful book on food and folklore. It's called Smokehouse Ham, Spoonbread, and Scubbernung Wine. It's by Joseph Dabney. I wouldn't miss eating my way along the coast of the Carolinas. Now, for that, you have to have Hoppin' John's Low Country Cooking. It's by John Martin Taylor. And last but not least, don't miss out on Edna Lewis's new book. It's called The Gift of Southern Cooking. Now, some of these are older books, so you want to check out secondhand sources. We're going to put the list up on the website. You'll find my Southern Fantasy Trip Backseat Library at splendidtable.org. International Food Authority Anya von Bremsen tracks culinary scenes around the globe. She writes for a clutch of national magazines and also happens to write award-winning cookbooks. Her latest is a collection of her global finds. It's called The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Anya, good to have you back.
Thanks.
Anya, I want to talk upscale beans and wieners. And when I think of that, I think of France's cassoulet, you know, that monumental dish. What's the story behind cassoulet?
Well, cassoulet comes from the southwestern region of Languedoc, and there are three towns along the Canal de Midi which kind of claim the paternity to the dish. One is Castelnaudary, and that, you know, according to consensus, is where cassoulet was born. At least, you know, that's the one that serves the most classic version. And according to legend, you know, during a Hundred Years' War, you know, in the 1330s, 50s, the town was under siege, and local women, to fortify the fighters, wanted to build this enormous dish using beans and all the preserved meats, like confits, that they could gather together. And the version from Castelnaudary is considered the most pure, and it involves salt pork, fresh bacon, sometimes slightly rancid for that piquant effect, and probably pork knuckle ham. Then the next town is Carcassonne. And there the formula is augmented by mutton plus red partridge in season. And then you have Toulouse, which is my favorite cassoulet, and that version involves plenty of confit, either duck or goose, and the saucisse de Toulouse, which are lusty garlicky sausage. And then you mix it all with beans in layers and in stages. It can take up to a week. I mean, it's really like an epic, mythical dish, and it's not an easy dish to make, but most people like it this way. Most people are happy to take a week making this dish. It's like the ultimate kitchen project, and of course the results are just sensational.
I have to laugh when you say that they did this for the fighting men, because when you finish eating all those beans, all that gorgeous fat, all you want to do is go to sleep.
Collapse, absolutely collapse. But I also just want to add one more thing. I mean, people talk about the meats that go or don't go into the cassoulet, but I think the beans are incredibly important. And my advice to the cook who is going to attempt this dish is to look out for really good beans.
Like what kind?
Like, for instance, like the tarbé, which is the original bean. Used in France, and you can mail order them, and I include mail order sources in my book, but beans have to take hold their shape and really be tasty and not overly gloppy, which for me is the curse of the many restaurant cassoulets.
Okay, so this is the epic dish, but beans are all over the place. Are there any other sort of national bean dishes out there?
Well, we have to definitely talk about the Brazilian feijoada, and I love it. It's just a great dish to serve, and it's black beans augmented with all these different meats, Portuguese sausages, linguiça, paella, cured ham, dried beef. Everyone has a different recipes and their regional variations, but it's just like this big, happy Brazilian casserole, and you have the accompaniments are very strictly mandated. It comes always with kale, which is shredded and stir fried. It comes with farofa, which is sort of dried mandioc meal, rice, sliced oranges, different chili peppers, and a lot of caipirinhas.
I mean, really what are caipirinhas?
Caipirinhas are Brazilian drinks. You probably had these at bars. They're very popular in the States. It's lime. Crushed with sugar and with cachaça, which is a Brazilian aguardiente, a Brazilian white lightning. Or you can also use vodka. So they're kind of sweet, sour, very potent. After three, you probably can't get up.
But this sounds like you invite everybody to spend the night and you turn it into a pajama party. So feijoada and cassoulet. Hey, thank you, Anya.
Pleasure.
Food authority Anya von Bremsen is author of The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. You can get Anya's recipe for the dish that I think of as Brazil's party on a plate, feijoada completa, on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're checking out the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Every week, we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique, and shopping tips. And perhaps best of all, it's free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, China's most audacious cuisine, the diet wars that divide the nation, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Fuchsia Dunlop achieved an unusual first for a BBC journalist. She was the first foreigner to be invited to study at the professional chef school in the Sichuan province of China. Well, Fuchsia became an East Asia specialist for BBC World Service and an authority on the food of Sichuan. She's written the first in-depth cookbook on the region that I've seen. It's called Land of Plenty, Authentic Sichuan Recipes Personally Gathered in the Chinese Province of Sichuan. Fuchsia, welcome.
Hello.
So how did you get invited into this school?
Well, it all began when a German friend of mine from Sichuan University and I, we just loved the food in Sichuan and decided we wanted to learn a bit more about it. So we just cycled over to this cooking school and said, teach us, please. And after long negotiations, the cooking school teachers agreed to give us a few private classes. And that's how I got to know them. And then later, when I finished my course at Sichuan University, I went back to the cooking school to say hello. And they just said, Fuchsia, there's a course starting now. Why don't you join in and stay for a few months? And I thought, why not?
So how did the students react to you?
It was really funny. I mean, I was in this class of about 50 students. Most of them were young Sichuanese men. There were only two other women. And of course, China in that period, these people had just never even spoken to a foreigner before. So they thought I was a bit weird and they were a bit shy at first. And they initially just called me Lao Wai, which means foreigner. And I had to insist that I had a name. You know, gradually I got accepted and made a few friends, but it was quite tough at first.
Was it especially odd that you were a woman?
Well, just that the catering industry is pretty much dominated by men, and women, when they go into it, tend to prepare the cold dishes rather than standing over the wok. It's really very unusual to find a woman chef.
Still in China today?
Oh, still. Yeah, very male-dominated.
You know, I think we need some geography. Can you explain where Sichuan is located?
Well, if you look at a map of China, then it's pretty much right in the heart of the country. And it's an area ringed by mountains, this wonderful, the Sichuan Basin, with very fertile soil and abundant produce, which is why it's always been known as the Land of Plenty, Tian Fu Zhiguo. And it's also a region with a very humid climate. It's incredibly steamy in the summer, and it's cold and damp in the winter, which is why the Chinese, with their love of medical law, say that you have to eat lots of spicy food, lots of chilies and ginger and pepper to drive out that unhealthy dampness and restore equilibrium to the body.
Sketch a portrait of the cuisine for us. What is the food like?
Well, I guess, I mean, the most famous thing about Sichuanese food is that it's hot and spicy. It's hot from chilies and it's ma, numbing from Sichuan pepper, this really amazing
spice. That's a Chinese term, ma?
Ma, yeah, it's the same word that means anesthesia and pins and needles. And it describes this amazing lip-tingling sensation that you get from Sichuan pepper. But apart from the spiciness, the cuisine is very, very strong on what they call fuhewei, which means complex flavors. So you get these very audacious combinations of flavors in a single dish, as, for example, strange flavor, which is one of the famous local combinations where you have sweet and sour and salty and nutty and spicy and ma, numbing, all these things going on together in a single dish. And they also have a saying, which is yi cai yi ge, bai cai bai wei, which means each dish has its own style and 100 dishes have 100 different flavors. And it's pretty much like that.
This was something I found really interesting, that as I got into the book, you have a whole section that there's like a code. You know, the way French cuisine has a code where there's five mother sauces and all sauces come from them. There are these codes. Could you explain them in detail?
Well, the Chinese have a very, very systematic and very sophisticated approach to cooking. I mean, it's very structured and analyzed. So, for example, in Sichuan, they have 23 official flavor combinations. And if you learn them, then you can use them to cook any kind of ingredients, really.
Now, you said strange flavor is one of them. What are some of the others?
Well, one of the most famous is yuxiangwei, which means fish fragrant flavour. And it's quite a misleading term because actually there's no fish in it at all. But it relies on the seasonings used in traditional Sichuanese fish cookery, which is to say pickled chilies, very red and intense, and ginger, garlic and spring onions. And then you have a bit of sweet and sour going on there, a bit of saltiness. And you have this wonderful sort of deep red sauce and all these different layers of flavour. Absolutely delicious.
You're making me crazy. I want to eat. But did the Chinese Cultural Revolution have any effect? I mean, that was a time, from what I understand, when so much disappeared.
Yes, I mean, I think all aspects of Chinese society and culture were really shaken up in that period. And of course, there was, you know, an assault on private restaurants, anything that was said to be bourgeois, and this creation of a socialist cuisine where you have big state-owned restaurants serving cheap food to the masses. So standards declined. There were no incentives for chefs, really. I mean, they got paid very low standard wages, whatever they did. And also the street vendors who had created many of Sichuan's famous snacks were all banned. You know, they were driven off the streets because there was no private economy. And so there was this very sort of dark period of Sichuanese cooking when everything stagnated. But fortunately, since the reform period, it's really come back to life, and there doesn't seem to have been much lasting damage. The old Chinese obsession with food has come back with a vengeance.
You know, I'm wondering about something because I'm thinking about, at least here in the United States, there is an obsession with anything hot flavored. I mean, we have seen books on every part of the Caribbean, you know, Mexico, you name it. We've not seen a book on this part of China. I mean, any thoughts for you? Because is it true in England has yours been the first book on Sichuan cooking?
Yes, it has. I think it's the first book in English about Sichuanese cooking that's actually been researched in the province. But I suppose it's, you know, for historical reasons that China was pretty much closed off for a long time. And it's only been possible to do this kind of research in the last sort of 10 or 20 years. So I was very lucky to be there at this moment when everything was changing.
Well, I'm very glad that you did it. And thank you.
Thank you.
Fuchsia Dunlop is an East Asia specialist for the BBC World Service. She's author of Land of Plenty, Authentic Sichuan Recipes Personally Gathered in the Chinese Province of Sichuan. Now, a great way to experience that idea of fish fragrant sauce, if you remember, Fuchsia said that there's really no fish in this seasoning, is, anyway, it's her recipe for a fish fragrant eggplants. It's a Sichuan classic, and it melts in the mouth. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. If you asked novelist Jay McInerney what changed most in his life when his book Bright Lights, Big City turned bestseller, after The Money, he'll tell you he really got into wine. So much so that he now writes about wine for House and Garden magazine. Jay, welcome back.
Thank you.
Jay, I've been noticing on wine lists and in wine shops, Sauvignon Blanc has been nudging Chardonnay from the spotlight. Why?
Well, there are two good reasons for that. And one is that Sauvignon Blanc is generally much less expensive than Chardonnay. If you have a winery producing both varietals, you're apt to see their Sauvignon Blanc being half the price. Another reason is that Sauvignon Blanc generally, in most of its forms, is much more food-friendly than Chardonnay. I mean, Chardonnay tends to be like that really obstreperous, drunken uncle that sort of shouts down everyone at the table. And it tends to overwhelm your a lot of your lighter dishes. You know, lobster and salmon are able to stand up to these big California Chardonnays. Not much else is. And Sauvignon Blanc just goes with a whole lot more dishes, and it's it complements fish dishes, shellfish dishes, lighter poultry dishes, instead of competing with them.
There's a broad taste range, though. I mean, I'm thinking, I've had Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand that taste like, you know, a mango. I mean, they're like a tropical fruit bowl, and then there's this other end of it. So let's talk taste range so that we have an idea if we go somewhere. Yeah. You know, we look at, is there a place? If I see California, there's one flavor.
There really is a There really is a range. And until recently, you could experience the entire range in California, where you had everything from sort of wines that tasted like grapefruit juice to poorly made wines that demonstrated what the French called a pipi de chat, the cat box aroma that Sauvignon Blanc really can be susceptible to if it's overcropped, if it's handled badly, if it's picked under ripe. But New Zealand, you bring up a good point, has suddenly found a niche in the wine world. They produce these wonderful Sauvignon Blancs that tend to be more fruity and tropical, like, grapefruit actually is the signature fruit, I think, that I find in those New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs. And it's a great place to start. Number one, they're not very expensive. And number two, they're really, really friendly. At the other end, you have the original Sauvignon Blanc, really, which is Sancerre and Puy-Fumé, which come from the Loire Valley in France. And these tend to be a little grassier, a little more herbaceous. At their best, I always think of them as sort of smelling like a newly mown field of hay.
That sounds nice.
They kind of evoke a kind of summer picnic image for me. But these tend to be a little more minerally, too, and they go very well with shellfish. Two other great areas for Sauvignon Blanc, which are emerging, are South Africa and the north of Italy, particularly the Friuli region. And then, of course, we have California, which is finally learning where to plant this grape and how to grow it.
So can you give us some specific wines to look for?
Yes. Well, I would recommend Brancott and Cloudy Bay from New Zealand. These are two excellent examples. There's a lot of great stuff coming out of California. I mean, you have big wineries like Kendall Jackson and Beringer turning out very respectable examples in the sort of $10, $15 range.
Mm-hmm.
Duckhorn is one of my favorites. Celine is a wonderful Sauvignon Blanc made by great winemaker Mia Klein in the Napa Valley. That's probably my current favorite. Oh, and then down in the Santa Barbara Valley, Santa Ynez Valley, I believe, there's a Babcock is my other current favorite.
Uh-huh. Anything from France?
Oh, I love Sancerre. and one of my favorite makers is Lucien Crochet, the Bourgeois family makes great Sancerre. We're at a very fortunate moment. If you buy almost any Sancerre or Puy-Fumé from the 2002 vintage, you're likely to be very pleased. It's the best in 7 or 8 years.
Oh, this is great. So 2002.
Yeah, so just, yeah, this summer, drink 2002 Sancerre.
Okay.
As the French are already doing in bistros all across Paris.
Well, that's easy. Hey, thank you, Jay.
My pleasure.
Novelist and wine writer Jay McInerney is author of Bacchus and Me, Adventures in the Wine Cellar. This political season finds our nation divided by the war in Iraq, gay marriage, and by political party. But commentator Julie Hausserman says there's another critical divide in America, and she thinks it's time to bring it out in the open.
My fellow citizens, I would like to talk to you today about a division that we haven't even begun to face in this country, one that threatens to break us in two. You see the signs everywhere as you drive down our highways. I am talking about low-fat versus low-carb. We see it every day. In the line at Subway, some of us order turkey, lettuce, and tomato again. And then there are others who have come to believe that bacon, cheese, and roast beef are health foods. Oh, I see your smug look at the checkout, you with your dripping fat wrap. I'm minding my own business with the hold the cheese and mayo. I do not want your bacon. At the restaurant, I am picking avocado pieces off of the top of my salad while you are pouring blue cheese dressing on yours. Sometimes we spy on each other at the gym. But remember, citizens, that the world is watching us. All the sushi, curry, meat pie, stroganoff, rotini, and spanakopita eaters are taking notice. They are watching us, and they are laughing at America. There was a time not so long ago when we American dieters were united. We shared the common bonds of cottage cheese and Melba toast. We did not eat ribs. Then, the rebel factions began to form. Atkinites, South Beachians, Zoners. Splinter groups such as the small but fierce Suzanne Summersizers started taking positions. And these insurgents rose up against fat-free Wow chips, holding their beef jerky sticks high. The Weight Watcherites, Slim Fastians, and Jenny Kregarians retreated behind their leafy greens. They stealthily spread low-fat cream cheese on forbidden bagel halves each morning. If you doubt that a crisis exists, I bring you evidence. The recent attack by the low-fatters against the beloved low-carb leader, Dr. Atkins. Unfortunately, the great Atkins has left this earth. But the low-fatters will not let a sleeping man lie. They unearthed previously classified documents, which they claim prove that Dr. Atkins was fat. That perhaps his popular meaty diet was just a cover for weapons of mass inflation. His widow says they're wrong, that poor, sick Dr. Atkins was merely bloated. Wherever the truth lies, it's clear that the Atkins corpulence crisis has led to increased tensions in the North American region. Fellow citizens of this free nation, how did it come to pass that we can no longer break bread together? We can't share pork rinds or popcorn. You say ketosis, I say halitosis. Now, I ask, can't we all get along? Let us begin to build a peace. It will take time for sure. But let us begin now. Let us begin small with the things that bind us. The dreaded bread and the hated potato.
Julie Hausserman is a writer in Tallahassee, Florida. Well, the lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Lisa from Boulder on the line. Hey, Lisa, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome.
My question is about shallots. I love to make risotto with shallots.
Right.
But I frequently find recipes that call for different numbers. And my question is, what constitutes a shallot?
Oh, you mean like when it says three shallots or four shallots or...
Correct.
Right.
Because I've seen, you know, a head of shallots that can be the size of elephant garlic and one that's the size of, you know, very, very small. So that's my question.
That's a great question because, yeah, it's like saying a medium onion.
Right.
I mean, we all see it differently. Okay. As you said, shallots, which are, they taste almost like a cross between garlic and onion. And they're small, and they generally, to me, always remind me of a pregnant garlic clove.
Yeah.
You know, they tend to be very bulbous.
Right.
To me, I would say that a shallot, one shallot, and I'm making a thing with my fingers right now, is probably about the size of a small fig. So we're talking an inch and a half, 2 inches in diameter.
Okay.
And that would, to me, be a shallot. And if sometimes they grow in sections, you know, like it looks like there are these huge cloves all attached to a root end.
Right.
So I would say each one of those huge cloves would be the equivalent of one shallot.
Okay.
The other thing is, this is a case, especially when if you use them in something like risotto, where more is not a problem.
Right.
So, you know, you're not in trouble.
Good.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
You take care, Lisa.
All right.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Here in America, we hail newlyweds by throwing rice over their heads. What's thrown for Chinese newlyweds in the rural parts of Sichuan Province? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, here in America, we hail newlyweds by throwing rice over their heads. What's thrown for Chinese newlyweds in the rural parts of Sichuan province? Well, in the Sichuan countryside, people shower newlyweds with Sichuan pepper and peanuts. Just like rice, the nuts and the pepper are symbols of fertility. Our guest this week, Fuchsia Dunlop, talks about this in her book, Land of Plenty. She says Sichuan pepper plants have so many seeds, they represent fertility. She also says Sichuan pepper is so fragrant that it was used as a scent long before it was used in cooking. 2,000 years ago, during the Han Dynasty, the pepper was mixed into the mud walls of buildings. By the way, not just any buildings. Sichuan pepper went into the homes of royal concubines. Now, the idea was you had alluring fragrance literally coming out of the walls and all that fertility business hanging in the air. And we think plug-in strips are new. All right, let's get back to the phones. You can call us 800-537-5252. We have Andy from Nashville calling. Hey, Andy, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, how are you doing?
I am doing swell. What do you want to talk about?
My wife and I were in a chili cook-off.
That's fabulous.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. But what I'm doing is I'm calling because I wanted to try to do something that was a little bit unusual.
Right, right.
But I was thinking, I love Thai food. And I was thinking, what could I do to make a chili that was Thai-influenced?
I'm
calling you.
Well, now, you know, when you say Thai chili, what comes to mind is what you would call in Thailand curry. Now, it's not like Indian curry, because this is what happens in Thailand. People make these chili pastes, and they're incredibly, they have tons of ingredients, and there are green ones and yellow ones and red ones, and everybody does slightly different ones. But the basic concept behind this is that you puree or you chop or you mash together lots of garlic, lots of ginger. You might add things like scallions and lemongrass and fresh hot chilies or dried hot chilies. And, you know, in Thailand, they use those small chilies.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy. I mean, this makes this it can take the top of your head off. Now, you don't have to make it that hot. But and then you throw in things that like this very salty kind of fermented taste of shrimp paste.
Mm-hmm.
You can even throw in a bit of lime zest or lime leaf. And you get this to the point where it's really fragrant. And then what you do is you take garlic and onion, fresh cut. You saute that and you add this chili into it, this chili blend, and you cook it slow in the fat. And oh, by the way, the chili blend has oil in it.
Okay.
Coconut oil is really traditional, but you could use something even like canola if you want to be, you know, healthy. And the idea is that you cook that until it's so aromatic you think you're going to cry. And you see the fat rising and the fat is going to be red from the chilies.
Oh, yeah.
And then you add your cut up meat or poultry to that. You don't even brown it. And you could also add some coconut milk if you want to really, you know, gild the lily.
Okay.
And you let that cook in that mixture until it melts away in your mouth. And it is so good. Now, there's a book, a couple of books out there that will give you basic recipes. But the, you see, when you go up on the internet, look for Thai curry. And what you're really going to get is kind of the Thai version of chili.
Sure.
So think about, one book is called Real Thai. And it's by an American, and her first name is Nancy, and now her last name has just dropped out of the back of my head. And it's really good, simple chili, you know, these chili blend recipes and lots of great ideas. Because it's really easy cooking once you get the chili made, and it tastes better the second day. So this is not going to be something, you know, you have to go nuts over. Another book, and this is much more detailed and demanding, but boy, it'll give you authentic, is called Thai Food. And I want to say it's by, his first name is David. And again, it's an English name. David Thompson.
Oh, okay.
David Thompson. This is the tome on Thai food. Also, anything that you see on Thai food by Mai Pham, P-H-A-M, okay? She did a book on Vietnamese and Thai food. It's a small sort of paper format, but very simple, but very good recipes. And I'd say go up on the internet, go to Epicurious and places like that, and you're going to find it's the curry paste you want. And once you got that, you see, you can throw anything in.
So you start with that, and then you basically...
Yeah. And then you finish it off with mint and fresh coriander and roasted peanuts.
Okay.
I mean, is this not fabulous?
Love it. Thai food is, I think Thai food is quite possibly the most perfect food on the planet.
Well, you know, I realize you're in Nashville and you're going to go into future chili contests with this. You're going to just blow them out of the water.
Well, we got second place.
You did?
Yeah, second place.
Andy, that's fabulous. Congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
Hey,
appreciate
great. Hey, thanks for calling.
Oh, love your show. Thanks a lot.
Thank
great
you.
Talking to you.
Thank you.
Bye.
By next year, he'll be the king. Nashville is going to change forever. You can call 800-537-5252, and we'd love to talk to you. We've got Sally calling from Steamboat Springs. Hey, Sally, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
My family and I went to Italy last year and had a great time. Mm-hmm. And in Florence, we went to a little hole-in-the-wall restaurant and ordered a side dish of white beans, and they were just it's just a side dish, but they were so good, and we've been trying to find a way to replicate those. I was wondering if you knew what that would be.
Uh-huh. All right, you have to describe to me, what did they look like? Were they oval, or did they look like oversized lima beans?
No, they weren't that big. I'd say they were like a pinto bean size.
Right. And were they dressed in anything? Like, did they have tomato or anything like that?
No, it was plain, but it just had such a great flavor. My husband and daughter said, well, tell her they were creamy.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem like cream was the ingredient.
No.
I would have said they were savory.
Right.
They were just really good, and we ordered a second batch. We never would have thought we'd order seconds of white beans. And the green beans were really good, too.
Yeah, I've actually, in Italy, I've been known to order certain vegetables for dessert. Because I just know if I don't pass this way again, I've got to have another bowl full, another plate full. I think I know what you were eating. It's one of the great classics of Tuscany. These are cannellini beans. All right. They look like a white kidney bean, and sometimes people actually refer to them as white kidney beans. And when they cook, they become so creamy. And the reason why I asked you if you had a slight hint of sweetness is sometimes there actually is my mouth is watering as I'm talking here. There's actually a sweet undertone to them. But you had them made in a very special way. And this is the deal. What you do is you soak the beans in cold water overnight in the fridge, or if you're in a hurry, and this is what you would do with all dried beans. You can pour boiling water over them, let them sit an hour, drain off the water, cover them with fresh water. But now you're going to simmer them, okay? You're going to throw in a bunch of sage, fresh sage, and you're going to toss in a coarsely chopped up onion and a couple of cloves of garlic. And you're going to add a little bit of olive oil to this. Now, the olive oil will stay in the water, but it has flavor. It's got to be a really nice extra virgin olive oil that smells like fresh cut grass, you know, and tastes really good and kind of peppery. And you're going to simmer those beans very gently, partially covered, until they're tender. And then what you're going to do is you're going to drain them. Keep some of the sage there, okay, and toss them with coarse salt and pepper. And a little more of that really good olive oil. And that's the beans. They're great. And traditionally, they used to be cooked in a Chianti bottle. You know those old-fashioned Chianti bottles where the bottle was set in like a basket?
Right.
Well, that round bottom glass would be laid in a pan. And the pan would be set over hot coals. And inside the glass would be those beans. So that's the basic idea. It's flavoring it with sage and garlic.
And then how much, when you say some olive oil, how much?
Well, what you want is maybe, let's say for argument's sake, you have 1 pound of beans. That's about 2 cups of beans. This is going to feed 6 people, except maybe in your family and in my family, it'll feed 4.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we make meals out of this, too. It's fabulous stuff. I would say that for that, you want about 1/4 cup of olive oil. That's 4 tablespoons.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, you are welcome.
Love listening to the show.
Hey, thank you, Sally. Thanks. And thanks for calling.
Bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. I have to tell you, you can get off on those beans. They are so good. You can keep them in the fridge and then just, you know, eat them with a little olive oil and lemon. We've got John calling from St. Paul. Hey, John, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's nice to talk to you. For Christmas, I received a cookbook from my sister called Paris Sweets, Great Desserts from the City's Best Pastry Shop.
And that's done by Dory Greenspan.
She's right.
Yeah, she's a regular on the show.
Yeah, and in particular, my sister recommended a recipe for something called Korova cookies.
Oh, yeah.
Which
oh, yeah.
These were invented by a chef who had a particular restaurant in Paris. So this is one of those, do I have to have the ingredients that the cookbook author says I have to have questions. And there are two, so I'll tell you both.
Okay.
I won't
ahead.
Try to pronounce the first one particularly, but
right.
It's fleur de sel.
You're very close.
And the second is Dutch processed cocoa powder. I have both salt and cocoa at home, but I don't have either of those, so
okay.
Do I have to go and buy them?
And you've never heard of them before, right? This is sort of a new thing.
It's a new thing.
Yeah. And it's a great question, by the way. All right, let me explain. Fleur de sel is this very pricey and very tasty sea salt. It's when you make sea salt, you have these shallow, you know, sort of dugout areas where the seawater starts to, you know, you fill it with seawater and it starts to evaporate. And the first crystallization on the top of salt is called fleur de sel.
Okay.
And it has to be hand harvested and it's very delicate. If you have a good sea salt or a good kosher salt. Kosher salt is big flakes. You may have to grind it down a bit, but if you've got that, you're home free.
Okay.
No one is going to know. Just don't use iodized salt because it's kind of bitter.
Right.
But no one will know you don't have fleur de sel in there.
Okay. And it calls only for a half teaspoon, which for those of us who are inclined to make do with what we already have on hand, when something calls for such a small amount, you're even mm-hmm. more inclined to
yeah.
cheat.
I mean, if you have fleur de sel, it's a great way to use it. But if you don't, I wouldn't, you know, as long as you have a good tasting salt. The Dutch processed cocoa is another thing. And it's not as hard to find as you may think. Sometimes it's called European style cocoa.
Okay.
One famous brand of Dutch process is Droste, which is from Holland, Droste. What it is it's cocoa that has been treated to make it less acidic. It's been treated with alkali. And it actually reacts differently chemically in recipes. Now, the korovas that you're talking about are cookies. And they're not like a cake that has to rise. I mean, it's not going to be the end of the world if you use another cocoa. But there's a different chemical reaction with regular cocoa versus the Dutch process. Dutch process cocoa tends to be milder, mellower, and darker in color.
Okay.
So I'd say here's a case where go out and you know, I think either Nestle's or Hershey's actually makes what's called a European style. I can see the can. It has silver letters on it.
Okay.
So I'd say that's something worth having around the house anyway.
All right. Well, I'll make an extra trip and I'll try the cookies. My sister reports that she's made them 5 times, either 4 or 5 times.
You've got to work to get these recipes right, you know?
She drools every time she makes them. So.
Can I tell you something? I made them at Christmas, and people were offering me, you know, fortunes for the recipe.
Okay.
And I keep the dough in the freezer, because when we have company the last minute, or I just want to serve great ice cream for dessert, I just slice off some Korova cookies, bake them up, and serve it with them. They're fabulous. And it's worth using a really good chocolate. This is like a chocolate cookie with chocolate chips in it, but you can break off, you know, you can break up some really good bittersweet chocolate for this one.
Okay.
And make these chunky chips. Oh, you are going to love this recipe.
All right. Well, I'm going to try it, and I appreciate the information.
Well, John, thanks for the call.
All right. Goodbye.
Goodbye. By the way, the recipe is on the website. They're called Korovas with a K. It's a cookie, and it's from Paris Sweets, and the website's splendidtable.org. The other side of it is, you really could buy the book. Dory's a great writer. Dory Greenspan, Paris Sweets. You know, support food writers. You can get to us, guys, 800-537-5252. You know the fantasy about discovering hidden treasure in your attic? Well, the same can be true of your basement, especially if it happens to be under a 119-year-old bar that's in the middle of a restoration. Building owner and restorer Kristen Murph Dawkins joins us on the phone from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Kristen, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
So now, Kristen, I understand that you're in the process of taking this building apart kind of and putting it back together for a bar, right?
Yes, a coffee shop. It's going to be a coffee shop. It's been a bar for at least since 1903 when the Hams Company put the original bar in there. And probably it was a tavern, maybe just buckets of beer before that.
So what did you find?
Well, digging up some of the basement floor, which is dirt and ash mostly, we found a stash of 33 bottles of wine, of which a number of them were still intact. And we brought in an expert, and he came and told us that probably seven of them might still be good.
Oh, boy. How old is the wine?
The labels indicate from 1906 to 1920, based on some of them say the Food and Drug Act of 1906, and some of them say the Food and Drug Act of 1920, which is when Prohibition started. So this is just pre-Prohibition.
So do you think they buried the bottles, I mean, to hide them from Prohibition? I mean,
that's one of our theories, yeah.
What's another?
Another is that maybe one of the employees was kind of pilfering, only perhaps he got caught and fired before he could take away his own stock there. And so it got left behind and unknown to all others. I can't tell. They were just kind of stacked on their sides, but there was no evidence of a wine rack or any kind of box associated with it. So
they were just buried.
Yeah.
What kinds of wines are we talking about?
A claret, the red, which is the same as Bordeaux, the expert told me.
Right.
And the white was a Riesling. He said the bottles were of a very, very high quality for that era.
Uh-huh.
And the corks as well, that he was amazed that it had, you know, survived intact this long. For him, it was the oldest collection of American wine he had ever come across.
I'll be darned. Are you into wine?
Oh, yes. I love wine. I'm no expert, but I do like my better wines, and I can't wait to try one of these.
So you are going to open them?
One of these days. I think we might arrange some kind of a very special gathering and invite over, like, my banker, for example, and certainly the expert and, a few other close friends for a very private little wine tasting. Yes.
That's a very smart idea. You're a businesswoman. Hey, Kirsten, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Kristen Murph Dawkins is a neighborhood activist and proprietor of the soon-to-be-opened UNI Cafe in St. Paul, Minnesota. Well, that's the show this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Art Buchwald. He said, "I like champagne because it always tastes like my foot's asleep." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it right on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Thanks for joining us. See you next time. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.